Shop the Sherwin-Williams Spring Sale and get 35% off paints and stains March 13th through the 23rd. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Are you afraid to start fertility treatments? I've had a lot of people explain to me that they don't understand what the fertility treatments are. And because of the unknown, because they don't understand the fertility treatments, they're afraid to start their fertility journey. And so they keep waiting months and months to see if they can get pregnant naturally. Well, the fertility treatments can really help you get to a baby sooner than later. On this episode, we're going to review various forms of fertility treatments, including IUI, intrauterine insemination, ovulation induction, so taking medications to make your ovaries produce eggs, as well as in vitro fertilization, IVF. So stay tuned. I will be discussing all of these options for you so you can feel comfortable with these treatment options and then go ask your doctor, hey, is this treatment option right for me?
This podcast is meant to provide information on reproductive health. It does not establish a physician-patient relationship, and we would urge you to contact your treating provider regarding your care.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the episode. Today, we're going to talk about two different stories, and we're going to use these as examples as to how to pick the right fertility treatment for you. The first one, let's call her Maria. She's a 25-year-old lesbian. She's been with her partner for 5 years, and they really want a baby together. They're worried that they might be judged, and so they're approaching me about utilizing donor sperm. As we discussed in the last episode, we did all of her testing, and her testing is normal. She has good egg quantity and quality based on the testing. Her fallopian tubes are open, and now they're deciding what mode of treatment to pursue. Then let's talk about a second patient. Let's call her Sophia. She's a 38-year-old female in a heterosexual relationship, and she has been trying to get pregnant for the last 5 years, naturally. She has become pregnant once in that 5 years, but had a miscarriage. And she feels like a failure. It's been 5 years and she's only getting older and older. And the one time she got pregnant, she had a miscarriage. I did her testing as well. Her testing shows low egg reserve, meaning her egg quantity and quality are much lower. Her husband, who is a 45-year-old male, his semen analysis shows low sperm quantity and quality, again, associated with age. And so they're struggling as well. They want to know what is the right treatment for them to get pregnant. They should have been pregnant 5 years ago, according to them, when they started this out. So let's talk about these two examples as we explore what treatment options are available to you. We're going to start off with ovulation induction. So what is ovulation induction? Ovulation induction is when we give the female partner medications that would make her ovaries produce the eggs. Commonly, we start off with pills like Femara, also called letrozole, or Clomid, also called clomiphene citrate. These are pills that a woman can take for about 5 days in her cycle to help her ovaries produce the follicles. She then returns for another ultrasound to see if that follicle grew from a small size to a larger follicle, so a mature follicle. And if it did, we would have her take one injection called a trigger shot, and that will allow the follicle to rupture or ovulate, releasing the egg. We also can utilize injections to make her ovaries produce these follicles. Now, these injections are called gonadotropins. These are synthetic versions of hormones that we make in our brain. So there is a gland in our brain called the pituitary gland. And this pituitary gland naturally releases FSH and LH hormones. So FSH is follicular stimulating hormone and LH is luteinizing hormone. And these hormones typically tell the ovaries to produce follicles that make other hormones, including estrogen and progesterone. So these women can take the injectable gonadotropins to make their ovaries produce the eggs. And then similarly, we would bring her in for a sonogram. And if the follicle grew from the smaller size to the more mature or dominant follicle, then she would do one last injection, called a trigger shot, to start the ovulation process. Now, regardless of whether she took pills or injections and then did the trigger shot, she can choose to do timed intercourse at home or an intrauterine insemination. So intrauterine insemination is IUI. That is very similar to a pap smear. It's a speculum exam in the clinic, and a catheter puts the sperm directly into the uterus. Her husband would have arrived to the office a couple hours prior, and he would give a sample, takes us a couple hours to process the sample, and then concentrate down the sperm into a smaller volume and utilize that for IUI, intrauterine insemination. The ovulation induction with the pills, like letrozole or Femara, we have a little bit more control with that. Typically, women will grow one or two follicles with those. Ovulation induction with gonadotropins can put you at risk for growing more than one follicle and put you at risk for multiples, a multiple pregnancy, meaning higher order multiples like triplets or higher, if you should ovulate three eggs at the same time. So many physicians today in 2026 will choose to do the pills like letrozole or clomiphene citrate over the injections, and then utilizing those to help you ovulate or produce the follicles, and then a trigger shot for ovulation, and then matching that trigger shot with either timing the intercourse at a specific time or doing the intrauterine insemination. Now, let's talk about IVF. So IVF stands for in vitro fertilization. All that means is fertilization occurred in the lab, so in vitro, versus in vivo, where fertilization occurs in the woman's body. So we mentioned earlier on timed intercourse and IUI. The woman would take medications, ovulate, and then either have timed intercourse or IUI. In that scenario, the fertilization happens in her body. We cannot see it, but based on the timing, we're assuming it's happening. IVF, the fertilization, meaning the combination of the egg and sperm, or the sperm fertilizing the egg, that happens outside the body in the lab. Today, we often use ICSI. ICSI is ICSI, so intracytoplasmic sperm injection. That's where in the lab, we pick up a single sperm and inject it directly into the egg. That often improves fertilization. We will also use ICSI for men with low sperm quantity and quality. We would also utilize ICSI if we were going to test the embryos for genetic testing, because with ICSI, it allows us to fertilize the egg with one sperm. If you did standard insemination in the lab, so you got the eggs and the sperm, you put them in the petri dish, you turn off the lights and walked away, and next day came back and look, in that scenario, you're allowing the fertilization to happen between the egg and sperm. However, there many sperm will be stuck to the surface of the egg. Even though one sperm actually fertilized the egg, you're going to have many more sperm stuck to the surface. And that makes it difficult to do genetic testing of embryos, because now you're going to have contaminant DNA from sperm that's stuck to the egg on the outside. So ICSI is often utilized today, and we're seeing better fertilization with ICSI. When ICSI first started out back in the 90s, it was used to help men who had abnormal semen parameters. Before ICSI, men with abnormal semen parameters, they were stuck with donor sperm at a certain point. If it wasn't working with their sperm, donor sperm was going to be the recommendation. But now, since we have the ability to inject the sperm into the egg, now we can improve fertilization and help men out as well who have lower sperm quantity. When the egg and sperm combine together, it's called an embryo. So an embryo is a fertilized egg. The embryo will grow in the incubator for several days, typically for about a week after the egg retrieval. So the day of the egg retrieval, we typically call that day zero. and the embryo can grow up until 7 days, day seven, after we've done ICSI. On day five, day six, or day seven of development, the embryo is called the blastocyst. That is, it's an embryo where you have cells around on the outside or lining the outside. You have a cavity called the blastocoele in the middle. You can clearly see the inner cell mass. The inner cell mass is what will become the actual baby. And you can clearly see cells called the trophoectoderm. The trophoectoderm are cells that will eventually become the placenta. So on day five, six, or seven, we can biopsy the embryos and test the embryos. Now, embryos that make it to the blastocyst stage on day five are right on track. Embryos that make it to the blastocyst stage on day six, one day later than the embryo on day five, but we get lots of babies out of day six embryos. And many labs today can culture embryos up until day seven. Now, even though you can get an embryo on day seven, that's good grade. The fact that it took two extra days to make it to the blastocyst stage does suggest to us that this embryo is already slower in development and perhaps lower quality. And we do get babies out of day seven embryos, but the success rates are a whole lot lower than day five or day six embryos. Now for the biopsies, let's talk about the biopsies. People are worried, will the biopsies hurt the embryo? Does it damage the embryo? Well, today we do so many trophoectoderm biopsies or PGT biopsies, and they're many skilled embryologists that work in the lab that do these routinely, that I'm less worried about the biopsy hurting the embryo. And everything I do, it's risk benefits. There's no 0% or 100% black and white. So in this scenario, the benefits of doing the biopsy and learning the genetic makeup or euploidy or aneuploidy of the embryo really helps us in selecting a good embryo over a very low chance of damaging the embryo with a biopsy. So when we do these biopsies, and we're going to talk about PGT biopsies, we're taking several cells off the trophoectoderm. Now, the trophoectoderm are the cells that will become the placenta. So we're not taking cells off the inner cell mass. The inner cell mass are the cells that will become the actual baby. In theory, the trophoectoderm and the inner cell mass have the same genetic makeup. So this would be very similar to what's called a chorionic villus sampling. Chorionic villus sampling is when they take a sample of the placenta at the end of the first trimester and test for aneuploidy. In theory, again, the placenta and the fetus have the same makeup or genetic makeup. So we're actually catching the cells much earlier on at the trophoectoderm stage before implantation and testing the embryo. Now we will take several cells off the trophoectoderm. Then we will freeze the embryos. It takes several weeks to get the results back on this PGT testing. Now, before we go down the path of PGT testing, I want to explain three different types of PGT testing, or what we can send off these cells for. The most common PGT testing is pre-implantation genetic testing aneuploidy screening. So that is testing, looking at the chromosomes or gene regions of the embryo makeup and making sure it's euploidy, meaning an embryo that has the correct number of chromosomes or gene regions, or aneuploidy, meaning an embryo that has the incorrect number of chromosomes or gene regions. Aneuploid embryos are less likely to implant, and if they do implant, do result in miscarriage. The most common one we see that result in live birth is trisomy 21, which is Down syndrome, but most will not implant, or if they do implant, will result in a miscarriage. So PGTA, pre-implantation genetic testing aneuploidy screening, looks for the gene or genetic makeup in terms of number of chromosomes or gene regions, and making sure the embryo has 23 pairs of chromosomes. So let's talk about that for a second. All of us have 46 chromosomes. Men have their 46XY, women 46XX. However, so these are 23 pairs of chromosomes. In growth of the embryo, you can get mitotic errors, where division is uneven in the chromosomes, and that's where you get aneuploid embryos. You can also get meiotic errors where it came from the egg or sperm and then resulted in the aneuploidy in the embryo. Now, PGT-A testing is the most common PGT testing we do on embryos, and we see when we pick a euploid embryo of good grade, then we have a much higher chance of having a live birth and a lower chance of a miscarriage. The second PGT testing is PGT-M or PGT monogene. So for example, let's talk about that. PGT-M, let's say in a family, the husband and wife are both carriers for sickle cell. So they both have the sickle cell trait. They're carriers for sickle cell, but they don't have the disease. But because they're both carriers for sickle cell, they have a 25% chance of having a child with a full-blown sickle cell disease, a 50% chance of having a child that's a carrier like them, and a 25% chance of having a child that's not a carrier or does not have the disease. I'm going to give you another example. Let's say you have a family, and in that family, breast cancers run throughout the family. And so the female decided to get tested for the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. BRCA is a common gene that can result in breast cancer. And it turns out she is a carrier for BRCA. And her mother, several of her aunts, her grandmother, all have had mastectomies or have died from breast cancer. And she does not want her children to have this. And so she will come to me and say, how can I prevent passing on the BRCA gene to my offspring? So that's where the PGT-M comes into play. I'll give you a third example. Let's say cystic fibrosis. Cystic fibrosis is also a disease, and it's a debilitating disease, can result in lung transplants as well as early death because the cilia that work in the lungs don't work as well. And these people will either need lung transplants or have early mortality. I'm going to use all three examples, the sickle cell, the cystic fibrosis, as well as the BRCA causing the breast cancer. All these people have certain genes that run in their family, and they want to prevent their next generation from carrying these genes. So these people would do PGT-M testing. So testing for monogene, M stands for monogene, meaning we're going into these embryos or into the biopsy specimens looking for a specific gene. So the family with sickle cell, we're looking for sickle cell in the embryos. The family with cystic fibrosis, we're looking for cystic fibrosis in their embryos. The family with breast cancer and the BRCA gene, we're looking for the BRCA gene in their embryos. So we will test the embryos for the PGT-M and look and see if the embryos carry these genes of interest for this particular family. Now, today in the United States, we don't deliberately create embryos to not carry the gene, but once the embryos are created, we can test them for those genes that run in the family and choose to transfer, meaning put back to the uterus, an embryo that does not carry the gene. And by putting back an embryo that does not carry the gene, the offspring or live birth does not carry the gene, and their children don't carry the gene. And subsequently, the rest of the next many generations, the gene is no longer passed on. So that's the beauty of doing the PGT-M and testing for these genes ahead of time if we know what specific gene runs in the family. The third PGT testing, preimplantation genetic testing, structural rearrangements, SR, meaning we're looking for a specific rearrangement in the chromosomes of these embryos. So remember when I talked about PGT-A testing and we said there are 23 pairs of chromosomes or 46 chromosomes total. While a small percentage of us human beings on this planet today, we have all the chromosomes we need for normal day-to-day function, the genetics that program our daily lifestyle, we have all the chromosomes. In a very small percentage of people, the chromosomes are arranged in the wrong pattern. So we have the chromosomes. Let's take this person, for example. This person has the chromosomes. The chromosomes are arranged in the wrong pattern. And so what we call this is a balanced translocation, meaning it's balanced. The person has all the chromosomes, but they're in the wrong pattern. part of one chromosome broke off and attached to another chromosome. Well, what happens is when the chromosomes in a person who has 46 chromosomes, in the egg and sperm splits, it divides into 23, two sets of 23. 123 in the sperm combines with 123 set of chromosomes in the egg to form a new set of 46 in the growing embryo. But someone with a balanced translocation, they may have 46 chromosomes, but let's say part of chromosome 21 and part of chromosome 15 exchange spots. Now, when those chromosomes go to split to form 23 and 23, that will eventually be combined with 23 from the partner, the splitting of those chromosomes are uneven because the chromosomes were not in their right pattern to start with. So that's called structural rearrangements. And now the resulting embryo has an uneven or unbalanced chromosome makeup, and therefore that resulting embryo may not implant or may implant and result in a miscarriage. So people with balanced translocations, one of the biggest things they come and see me and say is, we keep getting pregnant and we're young and healthy, we're 25, but we keep having miscarriages. And many times carrying a balanced translocation can be a cause of that. So with IVF, you can do IVF with ICSI, so injecting the sperm into the egg, then do PGT testing of the embryo. PGTA is the standard PGT testing that I recommend everyone gets, and that's testing the embryo for generalized aneuploidy screening. PGTM would be if there's a certain genetic condition that runs in the family, and we would prefer for the future offsprings to not carry that gene. And PGTSR would be if there was a structural rearrangement where it came from the egg or the sperm, and we want to test the embryos and make sure the embryos are balanced or have the correct number of chromosomes, we can do that as well. When we started off this episode, we had two patients that I used as examples. We had Maria, the 25-year-old lesbian, with completely normal testing. Her fallopian tubes are open, good quantity quality of eggs, just wants to use donor sperm and have a baby. And then we had Sophia, the 38-year-old female in a heterosexual relationship, has been trying for the last 5 years, has only been successful once in terms of getting pregnant, but resulted in a miscarriage. Her eggs tested low on egg quantity quality. Her husband's older than she is, and his sperm tested low as well in terms of sperm quantity and quality. How do we know which treatment is right for which patient? I will tell you, Maria, because she's young and her testing is normal. And the truth is, we don't even know she has true infertility. She's a 25-year-old lesbian just wanting to use donor sperm. Someone like her, I would say, let's start off simple. Let's start off with an IUI, intrauterine insemination. We can combine that with pills like Femara or clomiphene citrate to get her ovaries to produce the follicles in a predictable fashion and trigger the ovulation. Now for her, because she's young and her testing is normal and we're using good sperm, donor sperm, with good quantity quality of that sperm, her success rate with IUI is probably pushing 20% success rate per cycle. Now, the other person, Sophia, who's 38, poor eggs, poor sperm quantity quality, has only been pregnant once in the last 5 years, but resulted in a miscarriage. For her, I will say, let's go directly to IVF with this couple. I don't think they're going to get much out of IUI in this couple, or even ovulation induction with pills or injections. This couple, because their quantity quality of eggs and sperm are low, their ability to make good quality embryos will be significantly impaired. And so this couple, we really want to go through IVF. We want to do ICSI, where we're helping the sperm fertilize the eggs. And we really do want to do genetic testing or PGTA testing of their embryos and test for euploidy or aneuploidy and pick a euploid embryo of high quality and use that for the transfer so that they can have a higher chance of getting to live birth. Now with IVF, and picking embryos in this couple, the 38-year-old with an older husband, they may have to do IVF, ICSI, and PGT-A testing, maybe a few rounds before we get good embryos that are of good grade and test correct on the PGT-A testing. Since we're here, let's talk about a common myth. One of the myths I hear often from my patients is, well, I'm doing IVF, so that means I'm going to get a baby. Guarantees I'm going to get a baby because I'm doing IVF. Well, IVF does not guarantee a baby, and an embryo does not guarantee a live birth. And so in this couple who has low egg and sperm quantity quality, we may have to do a few rounds of IVF ICSI and PGT-A testing and test the embryos and then get a good embryo for transfer. Now we've moved their success rate from what they've been doing at home the last 5 years, which is about 1 to maybe 3% per month, to pushing 70 to 80% with a single transfer by picking a good embryo. Now I want to talk to you about another thing about IVF, because this is also a common myth I hear. Meaning age doesn't matter if you do IVF. And I'm here to tell you age still matters if you do IVF. So that 38-year-old woman doing IVF, or even my 42-year-old patient doing IVF, when I compare those women to, for example, Maria, if she chose to do IVF at 25, I'm going to get different embryos. Even if I get a day 5-5AA embryo in a 38-year-old or a 42-year-old, a day 5-5AA embryo coming from a 25-year-old still has a higher chance of resulting in a live birth. Same grade, and both all the embryos were testing for euploidy, the PGT testing. The fact that that embryo came from a 25-year-old egg, the egg has all the organelles and machinery needed to generate and grow essentially another human being, a baby, that 25-year-old has a higher success rate. Same graded embryo and tested correct on the PGT-A testing. So in the two examples we utilize, Sophia, the 38-year-old, should go directly to IVF. She's not going to get much out of doing IUI cycles or ovulation induction. Maria, on the other hand, she's a 25-year-old lesbian. We don't know if she has infertility. She's never tried to get pregnant naturally. And because all her testing is normal and she only wants to use donor sperm, she could use donor sperm with a success rate pushing 20% success rate with IUI. Now, a 38-year-old woman, I'm going to give you a different example. Let's call this patient Jane. 38-year-old woman, heterosexual relationship. Let's say she has reasonably decent testing on her egg quantity quality. Her tubes are open on the dye test of the tubes. And her husband, even though he's 43, has reasonable testing on the semen analysis. 38-year-old woman with an older husband, reasonably decent testing on the eggs and sperm with open fallopian tubes. For that patient, I'm going to quote them 5, maybe 10% success rate with an IUI versus Maria, the 25-year-old. I quoted her 20% with IUI because she's younger. So the age of the egg does matter. Even though this third patient that I call Jane had reasonable testing on her egg reserve, her husband has reasonable semen analysis, just their age alone means I'm going to get gametes. Gametes are eggs and sperm that are lower, that are not as good as that of a 25-year-old utilizing donor sperm. And typically donor sperm comes from a donor in his 20s or early 30s. So the age of the person whose eggs and sperm we utilize does matter in terms of IVF success rates. One of the common questions I get from patients is, well, we're doing IVF. Why can't you just put two back into the uterus and let's have twins? Let's just be done with it, get our two babies all at once. Let's talk about embryo's utilization for embryo transfer. I've been doing this for about 2 decades. When I first started off doing IVF, frozen embryo transfers were not as good as fresh embryo transfers because our ability to freeze and thaw embryos were not very good 20 years ago. 20 years ago, we were utilizing slow freezing and slow warming or slow thawing process. And then we discovered and started frequently utilizing vitrification, which is a flash or fast freeze and thaw. We see when you slow freeze, we get icicles or freezing within the cells of the embryo, and then it doesn't thaw as well. Whereas the vitrification, we get the embryo to freeze nicely and thaw nicely. So when I first started doing this, we were only doing fresh transfers, not frozen transfers. I will tell you, the tune I gave patients 20 years ago, you should do a fresh transfer, is not the tune I give today. I tell them, you should do a frozen transfer and do the PGTA testing. When I first started doing this, PGTA testing was not very good. Today, it is excellent. Initially, we were doing PGTA testing on biopsied specimens on day 3 embryos. So remember earlier on, we said that we biopsy the embryos at the trophoectoderm or the trophectoderm on days 5, 6, or 7 at the blastocyst stage. Well, when PGT testing first came out, we were biopsying the embryos on day 3. So 3 days after the egg retrieval. Remember we said the egg retrieval was day 0. We were taking 1, maybe 2 cells off the embryo at that stage. Well, taking 1 to 2 cells off an embryo that only has 8 cells, you're taking a bigger chunk off the embryo, versus taking 5 cells off an embryo that has hundreds of cells in the blastocyst stage. The embryo still is much stable at the blastocyst stage, and you're not likely to injure the embryo at the blastocyst stage. So when we first started doing these biopsies, we were doing day 3 biopsies, and we had a higher rate of damaging the embryos at that stage. That is not the case today. Also, when we started doing these biopsies on day 3, the embryo had not settled down as to what it was going to be, meaning we could take 1 or 2 cells off the embryo at day 3, but the embryo may autocorrect between day 3 and day 5, 6, or 7, meaning the genetic makeup we tested the embryo for on day 3 from that 1 or 2 cells, that's not what the embryo true genetic makeup would be on day 5, 6, or 7. So there's some correction in the genetics that happens in those few several days. So now we're doing the day 5, 6, 7 biopsies or blastocyst biopsies. You're getting more accurate information than when we used to biopsy the embryos on day 3. So back in the old days, I never said do the PGT biopsies, never said do the PGT testing, always said do fresh transfers. That is not what I say today. Today I say do the frozen embryo transfer, do the PGT testing, the PGTA testing, because that allows us to pick a better embryo for the transfer, increasing your live birth rate and decreasing your chances of a miscarriage. When IVF first started off, success rate maybe was 20%. Today, I quote 78-80% with my IVF success rates. So very big difference in terms of how the technology has grown in the last 20 years. So going back to that original question that the patient asked me, you're going to do IVF. Why don't you just put 2 back and just get her 2 babies and be done with it? Well, 20 years ago, I was doing that because the technology was not very good 20 years ago. We would put more than 1 embryo back to the uterus in hoping that maybe 1 takes. Well, what we observed in the younger women, we were getting multiples and higher order multiples, so triplets or higher. When you get those higher order multiples, the woman can have preterm labor. She could be on bed rest for an extended amount of time. She might deliver early. The babies could be in the NICU for a long time. So the neonatal ICU, neonatal intensive care unit, that's where the babies stay in the incubators in the NICU, sometimes weeks, sometimes months, to see them grow before they're ready to be released from the hospital. And so babies were staying in the NICU for an extended amount of time. If the babies were born too early, they could have permanent lifelong neurological conditions because they were born too early. So we were seeing a lot of complications from multiples. Additionally, with multiples, if they delivered at 23, 24 weeks, there's a chance that the baby could survive in the NICU. But if they delivered at 18, 20 weeks, we don't have the capability to sustain an 18 or 20 week fetus to stay in the NICU for an extended amount of time to term. Many times, an 18 or 20 week delivery would result in completely losing the pregnancy. So having these higher order multiples with preterm labor could result in difficult pregnancies, as well as complete loss of the pregnancy if the delivery was before viability, meaning 23, 24 weeks, when we would be able to sustain the fetus in the neonatal ICU. So at that time, we were transferring several embryos to the uterus, and some women had higher order multiples. And then there were lots of other women that never got pregnant, even though I was transferring several embryos to the uterus. I will tell you, 20 years ago, we were transferring 5 embryos to a woman who was 40 years of age and older. And the majority of that time, they never even got pregnant with any one of those 5 embryos. And that's because the technology was not good at that point in time. In the average 40-year-old woman, 65% of her eggs and embryos would test abnormal in PGTA testing and not result in a live birth or could result in a miscarriage. So doing the PGTA testing is so helpful, particularly for these women of advanced reproductive age. And that's 65% in a 40-year-old woman. In 41, it gets higher, and 42, and it becomes more and more likely to have an aneuploid embryo as you advance in age. So we were transferring many embryos to the uterus 20 years ago because our technology was not very good. Today, the technology is fantastic. We've optimized it. And I will tell you, science will continue to grow, and we will continue to optimize the technology where we can select good embryos. So today, the American Society for Reproductive Medicine really has come out and said we should only be transferring 1 embryo at a time to the uterus, and only unless this person has a very poor prognosis. So for example, someone who has failed 2 previous transfers where I've transferred good quality embryos that test correct on the PGTA testing, perhaps on the 3rd transfer, I would consider transferring 2 embryos to her uterus. But so only those patients with a very poor prognosis, we transfer more than 1 embryo. But really today, most good physicians will follow the American Society for Reproductive Medicine guidelines and transfer 1 embryo at a time. Another question I get is gender selection. Here's the big thing. Well, we want a boy, we want a girl. And when gender selection first came out as part of the PGT testing, doctors, physicians like me, we were concerned. We were worried about our morals and ethics, and are we deliberately transferring embryos to the uterus that because the couple only wanted a male or only wanted a female? And what was our comfort level like? And when I first started doing it, I initially was uncomfortable. I will tell you, I was uncomfortable. Were we going to become one of those countries that only wanted a specific gender transferred to the uterus? Or were people going to be balanced in terms of females and males in terms of which one I can transfer? And I will tell you, after doing this for so many years, it's a nice even balance. Some couples want a male, some couples want a female. Some couples, they have one gender at home and they want the different gender, so they have one of each. So I have not seen us be, as a country or as a society, choose one gender over the other. So for my patients, when I do that PGTA testing and look at the chromosomes and make sure they have the correct number of chromosomes or gene regions, I will know gender of the embryo. Now, we will never deliberately create the embryo to be male or female, but once we have the PGTA testing, I will know the gender of the embryo. And if the couple says to me, I would like the male embryo or I would prefer the female embryo for transfer, I'm okay with that. Many years ago, we tried in the United States something called cell sorting, meaning sorting the sperm. So the sperm is what dictates if it's a male offspring or a female offspring. The egg does not dictate if it's a male or female. It's the sperm that dictates it. I know back in the old days, centuries ago, kings were mad with their wives because they only gave them daughters and didn't give them a son. But I will tell you, it's the sperm that dictates whether you get a male or a female offspring. Several years ago, and we don't do this today, this is more than a decade ago, we tried something here in the United States called cell sorting, where you try to sort the sperm cells. And so some sperm cells have an X chromosome, some sperm cells have a Y chromosome. Remember I said men are 46XY, and when those chromosomes split, one X goes into one cell and the Y goes into the other cell. If the X combines with the egg, you get the female. If the Y combines with the egg, that's how you get the male. The letter X, in theory, has four arms. So one, two, three, four. The letter Y, in theory, only has three arms. So the two arms above and then one coming down. The theory behind sperm sorting was that perhaps the sperm with the Y chromosome were lighter in density because it had three arms and not four arms. And perhaps we could sort the sperm and figure out which ones are X and which ones are Y. I will tell you, I've also utilized, and again, this is from being in practice for so long, I've utilized sorted sperm and done PGT testing on the embryos. So let's say a couple came to me and said, we only want male, and they sorted their sperm for male sperm, or we only want female, and they sorted their sperm for female sperm. When we went ahead and utilized those sperm to create embryos and tested the embryos for the PGTA testing and understood the gender makeup of that embryo, it was still 50-50 of whether you got a male or female offspring. So we no longer use sperm sorting here in the United States because we did not see success with it. So one of the questions I get from my patients is, well, since we're doing this genetic testing, this PGT testing, can we test and pick the embryo that has a higher IQ or a certain eye color or a hair color? We have the technology to do that, but we do not do that here in the United States as yet. But we do have the technology to do that because the science has gone on or advanced so much more compared to the ethics and the legal aspects. We are trying to utilize the science to do good for people while we sort out the ethics. I mentioned earlier on, I had trouble internally with myself about how I felt about transferring a male or a female embryo because someone asked me for one gender over the other. And the ethics still has to catch up to the science. So while we do have the ability to pick certain embryos based on certain genetic characteristics, we don't do that here in the United States. Another question I get is, I had an IVF baby. Does that make my pregnancy more complicated? Will my baby be healthy once my baby's born? Well, when we first started doing IVF, we were doing fresh transfers. And fresh transfers meaning a few days after the egg retrieval, we would turn around and return the embryos to the uterus. Well, the woman's body did not have time to recover from all the stimulatory hormones we just gave to her for the IVF. And so we were seeing preterm labor, one related to multiples, so having more than one baby in the uterus at a given time, but also perhaps related to what I would call the hormonal environment of recent stimulation with the injections and now implantation and growing fetuses. And so because of those reasons, we were getting preterm labor and early deliveries. A frozen embryo transfer means that we would give the woman some time for her body to rest, and then we would restart or reprogram her body with very low dose hormones to get only her uterus or uterine lining. So the lining of the uterus is called the endometrium, and that should thicken over time with these programmed medications. So we would program the endometrium to thicken over a few weeks and then do a frozen embryo transfer. So fresh versus frozen. Today, I tell you, do frozen embryo transfers with the PGTA testing. 20 years ago, I said fresh embryo transfers, we couldn't freeze as well back then, nor was the PGTA testing good back then. And maybe 20 years from now, if you're still listening to me, I may have a different tune for you. But for now, frozen embryo transfer is the recommended way to go for embryo transfer. Same thing in terms of the delivery. Will my babies be healthy? Well, back in the old days when we had preterm labor, preterm deliveries, we had babies in the NICU for a long time, sometimes with permanent neurological conditions for the rest of their lives. Now women are making it to delivery at term. There's only one baby in the uterus. And so we're not seeing those complications of preterm labor and preterm deliveries. And so babies born today from IVF, they're healthy. The pregnancies are healthy. The babies are healthy. I would not be afraid to utilize IVF because you're concerned that you may have a difficult pregnancy or an unhealthy delivery or an unhealthy baby. I'm here to reassure you that doing IVF and being pregnant with IVF can result in a healthy baby, and you should not be afraid to do IVF. You know, I like to end my episodes with debunking old wives' tales. Well, I have a few of them to talk about today, especially regarding IVF. The first one is eating pineapple core. So pineapple has become the fertility fruit, and women think if they eat pineapple core, they have a better chance of the embryo sticking and having a pregnancy. And the reasoning along those lines is that the pineapple core is rich in bromelain, and bromelain is an excellent anti-inflammatory. However, I'm here to tell you that you don't have to eat an excessive amount of pineapple or pineapple cores just to get bromelain. A well-balanced diet is enough. And I'm also here to tell you, eating an excessive amount of pineapple core does not guarantee you that the pregnancy, that you will get pregnant and that it will result in a live birth. So you don't have to go eat a ton of pineapple. The second myth that I hear a lot is McDonald's french fries. And I will tell you, McDonald's french fries are really good. There's something special they put in those french fries. And I think this came along, the reasoning behind the McDonald's french fries was to get more salt into your system to help with fluid retention. So let me explain. Remember how I said back in the old days, we did fresh transfers and the women did not have time for their bodies to recover from the excessive hormonal environment from stimulatory medications. Well, that excessive hormonal environment from stimulatory medications in some women with good egg reserve or who responded very well to the injections or who were pregnant with one or more fetus at a time, they could end up with ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome. So let's talk about ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome here for a second. OHSS, ovarian hyperstimulation syndrome, is when there's fluid that's being pulled out of your vascular system and we third space it, meaning you develop fluid in your belly around your intestines, or you develop fluid in the lower borders of your lungs, in the pleural space. So it's called third spacing of fluid. So ascites, sometimes you hear people utilize that term for older folks who have liver disease where they have fluid in their belly. And again, I've been doing this for two decades. I've had to literally go in with a needle and drain fluid out of women's bellies back in the old days. Today, almost no one ends up with ovarian hyperstimulation because we have different drugs, we have different ways of triggering the ovulation, and because we give women a few weeks to rest after the stimulation, so after she's taken all those hormones, we give her body some time to recover before the transfer, it is incredibly rare today to see ovarian hyperstimulation. Now, the reason people came up with the McDonald's french fries, my theory is they were utilizing the McDonald's french fries for the salt intake. So in the old days, when women had ovarian hyperstimulation, we would have to remove fluid out of her belly, but in her vascular system, within her blood vessels, she was actually very dehydrated. And so she would need to drink lots of fluids, electrolyte-enriched fluids, as well as increase her salt intake. Saltine crackers was one of the things I utilized so much at that point in time. By taking in salt intake and by drinking electrolyte-rich fluids, her vascular system can then rehydrate, so it pull fluid back into her vascular system. So that's where the McDonald's French fries came along, was for the salt intake. You can still eat McDonald's French fries, but I will tell you, it's not the reason why you did or did not get pregnant with your IVF cycle. Another old wives' tale is the Brazil nuts. And the theory behind the Brazil nuts is that Brazil nuts are rich in selenium, and selenium is an excellent antioxidant. Well, also there's something called selenium toxicity. So I don't want you eating a ton of Brazil nuts, and at most maybe two a day. But honestly, regardless of whether you ate Brazil nuts or not, it would not influence whether you got pregnant or not. So you should not beat yourself up that you ate too much or didn't eat any Brazil nuts, because that did not influence whether you were pregnant or not with your IVF cycle. A diet in moderation is just enough. Another myth I'm here to debunk about IVF is wearing my lucky socks or lucky underwear. Or I have some patients that will go and design these beautiful t-shirts and wear their lucky t-shirts for the embryo transfer. And I will tell you, I love those t-shirts. I usually want to take a picture with those patients in their t-shirts because I love the creativity of the t-shirts. But it's just like you wear your lucky shirt or your lucky underwear or your lucky socks to the football game. Whether or not your special team won or lost a game had nothing to do with the fact that you wore or did not wear your lucky shirt. And it's the same thing for IVF. So don't beat yourself up if you didn't wear your lucky shirt or lucky underwear or lucky socks, because your success rate did not depend on you wearing a certain piece of clothing. But if you still want to create nice t-shirts and show up to your embryo transfer with your lovely t-shirts, I love those t-shirts. I enjoy the creativity. And I will certainly want to take a picture with you in your lucky t-shirt, because it shows how much you care and how much effort you've put into this and your positivity and your hopefulness. So go ahead and create those t-shirts, but don't beat yourself up if you didn't wear a special t-shirt, a special sock, special underwear, because it's not going to make a big difference whether you got pregnant or not. If it's going to work, it's going to work because of the science, not because you did or did not do something. Another myth I want to debunk is, how much rest should I have after my embryo transfer? Some people believe after their embryo transfer, they should be on bed rest for 4 hours, for 2 days. And sometimes you can say, tell your husbands, your doctor said that you can't get out of bed for like 9 months and you can't do any housework or any cooking because the baby needs to just grow. And that's okay. But I'm here to tell you that you don't have to rest for any extended amount of time after your embryo transfer or after an IUI. So when I do the embryo transfer, I'm putting the embryo directly into the uterus. You coughing, sneezing, doesn't hurt. The embryo is there. It's in a small droplet of fluid and it's in the uterus. We ask you to come to the embryo transfer with a full bladder. And I'm okay if you want to go empty your bladder immediately after I've done the transfer. The embryo is not going to fall out when you go urinate. So resting or doing certain positions or thinking you've done something wrong after a transfer or after an IUI is not the case. If the IUI or the embryo transfer was going to work, it will work because of the science, not because you did or did not do something. Thank you for joining me today and listening to the various forms of fertility treatments. I know I put a lot of science into this episode, and hopefully I was able to explain it to you that you will be able to understand and then take that information back to your doctor and say, hey, which treatment option is right for me, and help me understand what works best for me. If you enjoyed this information today, please like, follow, and subscribe to my podcast, and listen to the next episode wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Pioneer,